Welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. Today we're going to do Chapter 7 and 8 of Onward Christian Soldiers by Donald Day, 22 years in Europe as a Baltic correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. And let's begin. Trips. Residence in a single city over a term of years does not make anyone intimately acquainted with the cultural and economic development of a country. In order to see what is taking place, it is necessary to make trips through the country itself. Get out, drive around, see what the people are saying. Press the flesh. Traveling by car year after year through the Baltic states, Poland, East Prussia, and Finland, one always saw something new. It was easier to compare the rate of the progress of each country as we move into Chapter 7. And today's broadcast will be a little bit shorter because we're going to do less than, say, 20, 30 pages. A little bit, so it should be a little hour 15, maybe. Each year, the villages seem to become cleaner. Oh, he's talking about, in this chapter, he's going to talk about some of the trips he took, I guess, and some of the people he met, as opposed to a sit-rep situation report for an individual country, as we saw in, say, Poland in Chapter 6, other countries, the Latvia, Lithuania, etc., in chapters before. So, he says, traveling by car year after year through the Baltic states, Poland, East Prussia, and Finland, one always saw something new. It was easier to compare the rate of progress of each country. Each year, the villages seemed to get cleaner. More new houses were in evidence. Kind of reminds me of Missouri, and back in the 70s, you used to see all these dilapidated barns and structures out in the country, but now there's so much money, it's pushed out that you rarely see old broken down barns if you drive through the countryside. There's a lot more money out there as people move out of even the small towns into the more rural areas, pushed by diversity and just the growing number of people. There was a still surer sign of increasing wealth in the larger and improved barns erected by the farmers. The roads improved. Everywhere I found proof of progress and increasing wealth and a better standard of living, except in Poland. There, the countryside seemed stagnant. I traveled many miles by car in Poland. Proceeding from Riga to Warsaw, we generally started early in the morning. From Latvia to Warsaw, we generally started early in the morning, and at night we slept in some small East Prussian town near the Polish frontier and next morning continued the journey to Warsaw. I tried many different roads from the frontier into Warsaw. I tried coming up through the Polish corridor from Gdynia. I tried entering through Pomerania and proceeded via Posen to Warsaw, but I never succeeded in finding a good road or even one being kept in repair. So Day is staunchly anti-Polish. In the territories Poland acquired and putschd from the Germans, there had once been good roads. These were also full of holes and perilous to travel. Punctures were frequent because the roads contained many horseshoe nails. I found the Polish peasant helpful and courteous despite their miserable life, but it was not advisable for a Christian traveler to ask directions from a Polish Jew. After being misdirected on two occasions, I investigated and discovered there is a prevalent superstition among Jews that if they can give false directions to a Christian, they will have good fortune in their next business enterprise. Isn't that amazing? I mean, these Jews want to live among whites, and that's their attitude, is if I can cheat them by giving them wrong directions, I'll do well in my next business enterprise. That shows you how nutty, how hostile, and how superstitious Jews are, and they're famous for all that stuff. And believe me, that attitude, and remember, most Jews come from Poland. The Ashkenazi, or 90% of Jews, most of them come from Poland. Those are the ones in America. And that attitude carries over. Suspicious, paranoid, superstitious hostility. Hatred of everything nice and undegraded. And desire for lucre and the smallest bank account is considered of more value than the highest ideal. That's the Jewish mentality. Now we're on 86 and we're going to make our way today to 100. So after this recording of two chapters, 7 and 8, we'll basically be just about at the midway point of this 206-page book. And I think it's been good so far. I really enjoyed reading it. I hope you are enjoying and profiting from listening to this incredible stuff that Donald Day is talking about, giving you a picture of Eastern Europe. And it's hard, you know, as he said, we saw last chapter, it's very hard to get any kind of honest information, at least before the internet, any un-Jew filtered information coming to you from anywhere in the world, really, but particularly from areas where Jews had strongholds. Even today, with the internet, who knows what exactly is going on in Russia and the Ukraine? Everything is filtered through the drives and motivations and misdirections of Jews representing America and trying to achieve an effect in, say, Ukraine, and conceal that from the goy suckers. If Jews will mislead you on such a simple thing as backroads directions in rural Poland, then don't you think they're going to certainly lie about anything else? Because everything else is bigger and more important than that. And it's not like they're going to tell the truth about the big stuff and lie about the small stuff. They're going to lie about all of it. I further learned that after nightfall, one could not leave for a moment an auto parked in any Polish village or town. Even if the car were locked, thieves would remove the radiator cap, valve caps from the tires, tear off the windshield wipers, and everything else removable. The American flag, which waved in front of my car, was no protection. It was also stolen on a number of occasions. In the villages, it would create a sensation, and a group of Jews would gather to stare at this emblem of a country which had not yet learned to distinguish between European and Oriental, between a Christian Nordic outlook on life and a Slav mode of behavior and living, a country in which they were free to conspire and intrigue, and where they hoped they would someday occupy the dominating position that they occupied in Russia. He's talking about the Jews. Although I call these little settlements Polish villages, still a better name for them would be Jewish villages, for in many of them the Poles were in the minority. Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, at the beginning of their national existence, after World War I, declared war on the village. It was difficult to find a village in the two northern Baltic states. Like the Finns and other Scandinavians, the Estonian and Latvian farmers liked to build their farmsteads far from their neighbors. It took the Lithuanian government many years to replace the villages with farmsteads, but the result fulfilled the hope of the government. And basically, he's contrasting the Slavs and the Polish with the Germanics, and finding the Germanics greatly to be preferred. The squareheads versus the roundheads is another division he makes. The Slav type of village found in Eastern Europe has contributed little to the inhabitants of them. The three most important people in the village are the Starostvo, which we encountered last chapter, Starostvo, Starastvo, nominally the oldest peasant who decided most, sort of like the village elder, the alderman, the older man in German. Starostvo, normally the oldest peasant who decided most questions arising in communal life. Didn't that sound like Indians in America or something? The priest and the policeman. So the oldest peasant, priest, and policeman are the three principals in a village. The career and promotion of the latter two is dependent upon the amount of revenue and fines they collect from the villagers. It is largely for this reason that when a peasant obtains some money, either from the sale of produce or a remittance from some relative abroad, they either spend it for vodka or buried it in the ground. The average villager was afraid to reveal he had money, for this usually resulted in a visit from the priest or policeman. And remember, Day is very hostile to the priest, and he didn't like the culture that the aggressive Catholic Church has cultivated in Poland. For many years, the southeast corner of Latvia was the most poverty-stricken and backward portion of the country. Illiterate, with a high birth rate, and this is Latvia, southeast corner, illiterate with a high birth rate and an almost equally high percentage of crimes and disease, Latgalia's interests were chiefly represented in the Latvian parliament. Latgallia's interests were chiefly represented in the Latvian parliament by priests. It was this section the Poles claimed from Latvia. The Latvian government finally decided on radical measures. The land was surveyed, split into farms, the villages forcibly liquidated. The peasants, who for many generations had lived in squalor, exploited by the estate owners and blessed by the priests, were compelled to move out of these farms, or were compelled to move out on these farms. Results became apparent almost immediately. The sale of kerosene, sugar, cotton goods, three essential staples, kerosene, sugar, and cotton goods, increased with every year. This forcible emancipation was only a small example of government interference into the private life of its citizens. Its success certainly justifies similar experiments and on a larger scale. Some windy sage once remarked that the best government is the least government. This no longer holds true. I don't agree with that, but this is Day's book, and that's what he thinks. Life has become too complex. It is just as necessary for nations to protect themselves from rapacious organizations as it is to preserve society from the onslaught of criminals. It does not matter whether these organizations are churches who seek to expand their temporal powers, properties, and influence, or whether they are secret societies such as Masons, Knights of Columbus, Knights of Pythias, fraternal organizations of universities, or political parties. I'm surprised he didn't throw Jews in there, as whites require collective defense from Jews, but are capable of managing their own individual affairs apart from that, is my view. But he's saying, he seems to be in with the thinking of the time in every one of these countries. You had large, increasingly centralized socialist or communist or social democratic governments. Employing Keynesian deficit spending, that is, printing counterfeit money and using it to buy voters and to create gigantic projects wherever you looked in the world. And pretty much all that didn't work very well. But he feels that you need, life is too complex for that. The time comes when the activities of such groups in exploiting or preying upon communities and nations reaches a limit and they do more harm than good. They then either face liquidation by revolution or state control of their activities. But the state itself can easily be, and obviously is, worse than those organizations, to my way of thinking. I mean, look at it today. What does the state do in the U.S.? Why, it grows giant colonies of feral niggers. That's obvious. We all see and bemoan the EBT culture. But look at, even within the white population, the culture grows. A, there's plenty of whites who are scarcely any better. The lower six of whites are about on the level of niggers mentally. And increasingly culturally, as the Jews promote nigger culture through their TV, whites are tempted to, instead of look up, they look sideways or down to niggers because it's easier to be a black than a white. So there's a hidden appeal there. Also, the state subsidizes two other giant colonies of not very useful whites, which would be the military, one, and the NEA crowd, two. All these, every other solid working white who has an actual private sector job has to pay for, and all these promote anti-whitism through their policies. The military is very anti-white, although, of course, whites make up most of the special forces because they're better at fighting than anyone else. But nevertheless, there's all kinds of pro-female, anti-male, anti-white male, artificial promotion of blacks to leadership within the military. And within the schools, we know that they promote bogus doctrines the Jews instill in them through their teachers' colleges, which ultimately trace back to Columbia Teachers College. So all these normal whites are forced to subsidize their own tyranny through money extracted from them and used to grow feral colonies of niggers, endless international wars, gigantic bureaucratic class of, 55-year-old, short, salt and pepper haired, two foot wide assed women who are the NEA, who, their business, their racket is education. They hate learning. They don't know anything, but they're paid to go to all these conferences. I posted yesterday on White Privilege Conference, even Notre Dame is supporting it. You apply to be admitted to this White Privilege seminar, and if you're one of the 10 who gets in, then Notre Dame will fund your trip to the seminar. I think it's next March in Louisville. Now, just trying to give you a little bigger picture here. It's a little bit maybe unmannerly of me to disagree with the guy I'm reading, but you know what? We don't have world enough in time. I got to throw in my comments where they are, and I won't defend them anymore because that's a waste of time too. I'm going to read this, and you're going to get what Day says, and you're going to get my commentary on it, and that's how it is. All right, so he's saying we need the state to counteract these other very large organizations now that we've gone through the Industrial Revolution from, say, 1840 in England, 1870 in Germany, roughly, to the rest of the world after that. And now we're in the 1930, 1940, and we need the state to fight off these other organizations, is what Donald Day is saying. Such are the thoughts which come to mind when you travel by car along the bumpy tracks which pass under the name of roads in Poland. He's saying basically no one's maintaining the infrastructure at all. You also have time to contemplate the scenery as progress is slow. As one passes village after village with their thatched roofs, unfenced fields, ill-kept garden patches, where fruit trees and berry bushes are notably absent, and with swarms of undernourished, rickety, ragged, and barefooted children, one becomes appalled at the general poverty. The egotistical, comforting thought that perhaps those peasants are contented because they know nothing better and are used to a struggle for a meager existence does not satisfy one's conscience. Uh-oh, his Christian conscience is flaring up. No good can come there. One very seldom sees even a substantial school building which might be considered a sign of better things to come. Miles ahead at the crossroads, surrounded with dingy, unpainted buildings and a few stores, looms the spires of a church so large that it dwarfs the tall trees beside it, a church containing so many bricks that the building material it contains would construct several hundred substantial farmhouses and barns. It is the kind of landscape which one pictures existed back in the Middle Ages. One almost expects to see a knight in armor accompanied by his squire approaching instead of a motorcycle with a sidecar operated by Polish soldiers bouncing crazily from one side of the road to the other in a mad ride to some local staff headquarters. As we move on to page 88. The imposing church and the tiny peasant huts, the plump priests and emaciated peasants. The sinister, sallow-faced Jews in their long black kaftans and greasy little picky. You know what? I'm going to look that up, how to pronounce that, because otherwise I'm just an ignoramus. And I'm bogus. Well, I don't find pisee, P-I-C-E-E. But clearly he means the curls, the forelock curls. So I looked up, I found payot is the Hebrew word for side locks or side curls. Those are the repugnant looking strands of hair that are curled up and kind of in front of their ears down below their jaws of these nasty Jews. And payot are worn by some, and there's a million variations of payot. Peyote, payot, peyos, peyos, peyois, peyois. Is the Hebrew word for side locks or side curls. Peyot are worn by some men and boys in the Orthodox community based on an interpretation of the biblical injunction, the Jewish Orthodox biblical injunction against shaving the quote-unquote corners of one's head. Literally, peyah means corner, side, or edge. There are different styles of peyot among Haredi, Yemenite, and Hasidic Jews. Yemenite Jews call their side locks simonim, Hebrew, literally signs. I can't pronounce the Hebrew. I don't speak Hebrew. Because their long, curled side locks served as a distinguishing feature in Yemen. Okay, that doesn't matter. But the Torah says, you shall not round off the peyot of your head. You shall not round off the corners of your head. So that's the reason that they grow those disgusting-looking little ringlets. According to Maimonides, shaving the side locks was a heathen practice. There is considerable discussion in the halachic literature as to the precise location of the peyot and the ways in which their removal is prohibited. All right, I guess that will do for that, and we'll go back to the book. The reasoning behind Jewish side curls. Okay, so the sinister, sallow-faced Jews in their long black kaftans and greasy little payot, I guess that's what I'm calling it, dangling before their ears, the hollow-eyed children and the horses, straining at their rope harness, pulling loads, exacting their last ounce of strength, spring, summer, autumn, winter, you could always count their ribs. Did they ever get enough to eat when the country was covered with grass? No matter whether their owners were peasant or priest, soldier or Jew, the horses were always starved. They fitted into the pervading picture of hopelessness, of poverty. For some reason, the Poles prefer a mongrel horse with a strain of Arab blood, unfitted for heavy farm work, and the blind horses, but I have already told about them. He mentioned that last chapter. The journeys we made by car 3 or 4 times each year in all seasons and weather from Riga to Warsaw were adventures. We would start early in the morning. The road through Maitan, M-I-T-A-N, and Meteni, M-E-I-T-E-N-E, to the Lithuanian frontier was always kept in good condition by the Latvians. Sometimes we would encounter on the frontier the car of the Belgian minister to Latvia, a notorious tightwad. Meat, poultry, butter, eggs, and some other products were a trifle cheaper in Lithuania than Latvia. This diplomat would travel to Joniskis, J-O-N-I-S-K-I-S, just across the frontier, purchase enough provisions to last a fortnight, and save perhaps $5 or $10 on each journey. Constructed by Russian engineers during the reign of Catherine the Great, the post road running from Petersburg to Riga and through Lithuania to Tilsit sometimes goes for many miles in a straight line. Although there is little important traffic along this road, the Lithuanians kept it well repaired. The two largest towns passed in Lithuania are Shaulen and Taurogan, S-C-H-A-U-L-E-N, Shaulen, and Taurogan, T-A-U-R-O-G-G-E-N. The two largest towns passed in Lithuania are Shaulen and Taurogan. In 20 years of Lithuanian rule, many thousands of farms appeared on the countryside. Thousands of farms appeared in the countryside, and hundreds of new modern buildings were erected in the towns. Lithuania revealed much greater progress in all sections of the country than could be observed in any district in Poland. So Poland is kind of stagnating, and Lithuania is getting much better in the interwar, between-war period. Particularly noticeable were the many modern school buildings. Children were healthier, people were better dressed, farmers were building modern dairy barns, scrub cattle were being replaced by thoroughbred strains. Even the Lithuanian pig took on a more aristocratic shape to provide more enticing hams for export. That's funny. So farmers, they're building better barns, their pigs are eating better, getting better, more tastier, better looking. And they're upgrading their cattle strains. There was a large illegal traffic in foodstuffs over the East Prussian frontier, which continued from the inflation period down to the outbreak of the New World War. And roast goose was the cheapest delicacy in Lithuania. In these lean days in Finland, the stomach frequently unfolds pages of mouth-watering memories. The pessimists wonder if such stomach-filling days will ever come again, now that the war is on, or the communists have moved in. The optimist, in thrilling anticipation, can already picture a roast goose stuffed with apples, accompanied by an equally fragrant dish of sauerkraut and other trimmings being placed on the table. The optimist gets far more out of life than the pessimist. Why, he can even picture himself regretfully refusing to have a second helping, or rather a third helping, of one of the most toothsome delicacies produced by creation. Even though at the moment he feels he could absorb an entire goose by himself. To come to think of it, that is another thing we are fighting for over here in Europe. A roast goose for everybody, not just for the commissars. So he's saying that roast gooses are really, really good. I guess up in that part of the world, that's a real delicacy. Now he says, East Prussia does not appear to be a large district on the map. Far from end to end, it is solidly German. It is irrelevant that some of its churches still conduct their services in the Lithuanian language, or that many of its inhabitants have names of Lithuanian or Polish origin. What does matter is its manicured landscape presents views of continuous delight to a farmer. Its forests are as carefully cultivated as its... That is something I noticed in a journey. I was like, wow. The forests honestly look like they've been combed. That's the effect when you're driving down like the Autobahn and you're just looking out. You're like, wow, God almighty. It's much... Stuff in like, say, Missouri is very nice, but it's much more rough cut. But in Europe, where they don't have as much room and it's been, you know, civilized and lived in for, you know, thousands of years, it really is. It's like they've taken a comb and just gleaned it and carefully... whipped it up. It has the same effect of like a someone's really well coiffed hair. the individual trees being hair strands. But he says, its forests are as carefully cultivated as its fields. Its roads are as neat as the German housewife keeps her children. Its fields are fenced. The pastures contain herds of thoroughbreds, both cattle and horses. Its farms, large and small, are efficiently and beautifully cultivated. In East Prussia, the traveler feels himself in the modern world, an orderly society with a high living standard and an old culture. There are poor people, as there are everywhere, but there is no stark poverty. Life's good things seem to be most evenly divided, as, for instance, they are in Sweden. Frontiers make patriots, but in the case of East Prussia, they have also been a spur to progress, an incentive towards efficiency. East Prussia reveals the gulf separating the German from the Slav. Its frontiers mark the demarcation of Western civilization and Eastern despotism. But not all of its frontier, for the same German culture, or should one say Nordic culture, exists in the Baltic states, which, if they had been blessed with a century of peace, would have evolved into other East Prussias, other strongholds against the East. So, again, he's repeating his theme. Germanic stuff is organized, regular, clean, competent, and simply superior to Slavic, particularly Polish. Now he says, Tilsit is a friendly little town. One Christmas Eve, a heavy snowstorm made further travel impossible, and we remained in Königlicher Hof. That's like Kingsley Court, more or less. König is king in German. Lich, L-I-C-H, is Li. Is an adjectival form, and ending, and a Hof is a courtyard. The restaurant was, and you'll see Hof and all the different beers, you know. Think Court, King's Court. The restaurant was closed, for the staff was gathered round the Christmas tree. We were not invited to this intimate little ceremony, but they brought a little Christmas tree with a dish of Pfefferkuchen to our room. P-F-E-F-F-E-R, that's German for pepper, like Hassenpfeffer. Pfefferkuchen, so pepper cake. I don't really know what that is. Now, we'll, in keeping with Ben Franklin's injunction. Okay, I looked it up. Now, Pfefferkuchen, more commonly, I guess, called Lebkuchen, Kuchen means cake, is a traditional German baked Christmas treat, somewhat resembling gingerbread. How about that? The forerunner of today's Lebkuchen was honey cake, and its history can be traced back to the Egyptians, the Greeks, and the Romans. They believed that honey, the only sweetener widely available to them, was a gift of the deities and had magical healing powers. Honey cakes were also worn as a talisman in battle or protection against evil spirits. Lebkuchen was invented by monks in Franconia, Germany, in the 13th century. Lebkuchen bakers were recorded as early as 1239 in Ulm. Okay. I did not know that, but I know that now. So, Pfefferkuchen is basically Lebkuchen. So, it's some kind of little cakey baked good thing. We went to church up the main street to discover the pastor was preaching his sermon in Lithuanian. That evening, we played with the toys we had bought for our child friends in Riga. En route to Warsaw, we generally traversed Tapiau, Friedland, Bartenstein, Ortelsborg to Willenborg on the Polish frontier. The first one was Tapiau, T-A-P-I-A-U. The others are spelled like they sound. Germanic spelling is regular in that there are set pronunciations for letters. It doesn't vary nearly as much as English does. We spent the night at one of the latter towns, for I would never risk a night journey in Poland. Allowing for one or two punctures, the trip from the frontier to Warsaw, a distance of just 100 miles, took 5 to 7 hours, depending on the state of the roads. Wow. So you couldn't really manage more than 20 miles per hour. In fact, less, 15 miles per hour to 20 miles per hour. After 1933, on these journeys through East Prussia, I occasionally caught glimpses of the new German army. So after Hitler took power in 33, in East Prussia, he could see glimpses of the new German army. Wonderfully trained and splendidly equipped, these troops were seldom encountered on the main roads. Test marches and maneuvers were conducted on side roads where there was less traffic. The sight of these German military preparations was welcome to anyone coming from the Baltic states who knew the plans of Bolshevik Russia. Military experts, including Latvians and Estonians, who had served in the Imperial Tsarist General Staff, told me one German soldier was equal to 8 Russians. This estimate was based on experiences of the World War. So, the thing here is, Donald Day is white, is not a Jew, is a Christian, clearly sees that Germans and their culture and Germanic culture, which includes and embraces the Nazis, is on our side. And the Jew-run Slavs are against us, but particularly the Jews need to be defeated. He sees that clearly, and a lot of people in America saw that clearly. Today, it's unthinkable, except on the internet, where people are coming to realize the truth. Since the Jews can't stop me from writing and recording stuff that I convey to you, and they can't stop you from conveying it to your relatives and your family. So, we traversed other routes from Tilsit to the Polish frontier. Sometimes stretches of little-used roads, which would be in excellent condition on one trip, within a period of some weeks when we passed the same way, would be filled with holes. There had been exceptionally heavy traffic. Then some signposts would announce that special police permits were required to pay visits to people living in these districts. Photographing was strictly forbidden, so it was evident that even more powerful fortifications had been erected facing eastwards. They were completely concealed by the hills and forests. To understand the East Prussians, we're on page 190 now, so we have another 10 to go, but we're still in chapter 7. To understand the East Prussians, one must comprehend their love of work. I have found this to be characteristic of the German everywhere, both in the United States and in Europe. But in East Prussia, it is paramount. I have been visiting on estates where the Baron would rise at 5 o'clock to begin his day, just as busy and filled with work as the day of his farmhands. This love of work is not solely due to a spirit of acquisitiveness. It seems to come more from a love for efficiency, from a desire to accomplish as much as possible in the space of a short lifetime, from the knowledge gathered from past generations that any moment this work might be interrupted by war. That's interesting. Sometimes one gained the impression that an East Prussian would rather work than make love. There is not much gaiety in East Prussia. A glance at the store windows in Königsberg, Pilkallen, as it sounds, like, L-Y-C-K, and Gilgenburg, G-I-L-G-E-N-B-U-R-G, reveals the women like to dress in somber colors. The favorite color is black, then comes dark greens and purples. Wars and the ever-present threat from the East have laid a heavy hand upon this country. Yes, the women of this frontier have mourned their dead in many, many wars. The more I learned about East Prussia and its inhabitants, the more difficult it became not to laugh when I heard the Polish chauvinists voice their claims that this territory should be annexed to Poland. In the Polish corridor, it was possible to see what would happen. There, the estates and larger farms were fighting a losing battle against the Polish state, which was confiscating their lands piecemeal and settling ignorant, lazy, incompetent peasants upon plots of soil not large enough to provide them with a decent standard of living, even though they farmed it efficiently. The Polish government assisted the settlers to build a hut, but not a barn, so they kept their livestock in their one room, and the entire family slept on top of the stove. Many were too indolent to dig a well, and the slovenly women walked long distances to obtain water from an unclean pond or stream. I mean, that's freaking nigger-like. It was not hard to imagine East Prussia's fate should it fall into the hands of the Poles. The corridor was a wedge of depravity in the body of Germany. It evoked a wound which rankled for many years and showed no signs of healing, but instead grew more foul. Bromberg, Thorn, and other towns in the corridor, which I visited frequently, resembled the towns of East Prussia, but they were German-built towns inhabited by other races. The Germans had been replaced with Poles and Jews. Buildings deteriorated from lack of repair. Streets were filthy. Shop windows were dirty and displayed inferior goods. Everywhere was evident the corridor now contained a different culture, a backward and lower culture. Not all whites are equal, any more than races are equal. When one heard the professional Polish patriots declaiming where Poland's future frontier should extend, one was amazed the Poles were not first thinking of putting their own house in order before aspiring to acquire more of other people's property. As it was, their houses already contained enough of other people's property obtained illegally through putsches. There was only one conceivable solution to the corridor problem. That was to raise the living and cultural standard of Poland's to equal those existing in Germany, and then opening the frontier as much as possible to promote neighborly relations between the peoples living on both sides of it, like the American-Canadian frontier. But that was impossible. And you remember last segment in his discussion of Poland, he pointed out how the British and French ambassadors undermined, I think it was Pilsudski's policy to have good relations with Germany. So they wanted to sabotage the relations with Germany and keep them in line with France and Britain to undermine Germany. I sometimes brought foreign friends with me by car across the frontier to Warsaw just to show them the difference between Willenberg and Korzali, C-H-O-R-Z-A-L-E, Willenberg, W-I-L-L-E-N-B-E-R-G, just to show them the difference between Willenberg and Korzali, two small towns just 5 miles apart, separated by an imaginary line drawn by man across a landscape. There were 2 centuries difference contained in those 5 miles. I felt it was something that had to be seen to be believed. That's how stark the difference between Polish and German culture is, he's saying. It's interesting. I have not personally been in Poland. I've been in East Germany, but not all the way to Poland. The greatest contrast was between the children. In Willenberg, they wore shoes and stockings and looked as though they had daily contact with soap and water. Korzali, many children were barefoot, even in November. In Willenberg, the children sucked lollipops. In Korzali, they gnawed raw potatoes. Now, there was no special difference in the character of the land. Both towns were surrounded by estates and farms. There was less forest in Poland because much of the woods had long disappeared into the stoves of the peasants, and little planting or proper cultivation had been done. There seemed to be only one conclusion to be drawn, that these contrasts were due to the difference existing between the nature and capabilities of the inhabitants. Geography may have much to do with the forming of the character of people and nations, but landscapes are frequently altered by man. Landscapes can tell us the nature of the men inhabiting them. In all the Nordic countries, many had not only learned how to combat nature, but also how to cooperate with her. Trees not only line the road by the brooks, but they break the monotony of the meadows and adorn the farmstead. Everywhere one sees a love of nature, which is also a love of beauty. This love of beauty is, of course, not confined to the Nordic countries. I have also seen it in the lonely little potted geranium in the tiny window of a Polish peasant's hut. But it more often is encountered in the north. You often find that in places where nature has fought the hardest, she has loved the most. And that closes chapter 7. Trips. And so we'll begin with chapter 8, The Downfall of Democracy. This, like 7, will not be a long chapter. We just have another 8-9 pages to go for today's segment. Some Poles like to assume that the United States has a debt to Poland because a few Poles assisted the Americans in our Revolutionary War. If this debt did exist, then it was paid many times over by the support the American government gave to Polish aspirations for independence, and by assisting to finance the last Polish Republic. The Polish government, again, this is the downfall of democracy, the Polish government viewed the United States as an object for exploitation. Besides expediting to America her unassimilable Jewish and other minorities, Poland was intensely interested in preventing the Americanization of 5 million Poles already in the United States. The Polish government maintained and subsidized a large organization for this purpose in Warsaw. Free trips to Poland, decorations for the deserving, and a never-ending flood of propaganda contributed toward this aim. These activities paid big dividends. The remittances from America averaged from $12 to $14 million per year. They were not affected by the Polish government's default on its debt to America. Just a tiny little 1% like Israel is flying all the little Yidlets over to Israel and back, and flying all kinds of journalists over there too, to steep them in the lies and to get them thinking the way Jews want. In 1933, some member of the Polish government conceived the idea of convening a quote-unquote World Congress of Poles in Warsaw. Elaborate preparations were made, and the Congress met in the summer of 1934. 1934, World Congress of Poles in Warsaw. World Congress of Poles. The World Polish Alliance Charter was supposed to be kept secret until brought up for vote. The government hoped its paid foreign agents and subsidized Polish organizations abroad, you know, there's a lot of Polish papers. Day is constantly talking about how his dispatches will be picked up in these ethnic Polish papers in the U.S. The government hoped that its paid foreign agents and subsidized Polish organizations abroad would be successful in hastening the adoption of the charter with a minimum of discussion. As we move to page 94, I succeeded in obtaining a copy of this charter and translating it, discovered it was merely a plan to enable the Polish government to obtain complete control of Polish organizations in the United States. Two of these, the Polish National Alliance and the Polish Roman Catholic Union, were fraternal insurance organizations with resources amounting to many millions of dollars. Both sent delegations to Warsaw. John Cudahy, the American ambassador to Poland, called in the leaders of the Polish-American societies and explained to them the would-be Congress was a maneuver to obtain control of their organizations and funds and advised against any affiliation with the project. So, American-Polish groups are sending representatives over to this World Congress of Poles, and the U.S. ambassador is telling them, look, the guys in Poland are trying to get control of your groups for their own interests. The Congress met in the hall of the Polish Parliament. Foreign Minister Beck and most of the Polish cabinet attended. That's how serious it is. John Quick, K-W-I-C-K, president of the PNA, the Polish National Alliance, made a speech. He bluntly told the assembled delegates that the American contingent felt themselves to be Americans of Polish descent and not Poles, that they had come to Warsaw to attend the Congress, but not to pledge their allegiance to either the Congress or to the Polish government. With this speech, the entire Congress collapsed. The festive ceremony, which had been arranged to take place in the Wawel Castle, W-A-W-E-L, in Krakow, when the charter was to be signed, was canceled. So they had all these hopes and dreams they're going to have a little festival after they co-opt these people, and now they realize it's not going to happen, so they cancel their festival. After the adjournment, I interviewed Quick in the dingy government hotel adjoining the Parliament House, and he repeated and amplified his statements in English. I cabled the story home. This dispatch caused much discussion among Polish organizations in America, and Quick, before he left Poland, and he's out of the Polish National Alliance, denied his interview with me. This made no impression on the Tribune, which published an editorial praising the position taken by the American delegates. The Polish government felt they had wasted a large sum of money and an entire year of calculated intrigue to obtain control of the resources of these rich societies. The intrigues were continued, but were now directed against Mr. Cudahy and myself. After many unpleasant experiences, we both left Warsaw. Mr. Cudahy became American Minister to Ireland, and I returned to Riga. We were both happy at the change. Ambassador Cudahy ably represented the United States in Poland. He was an old friend of Colonel McCormick, publisher of the Tribune, who had instructed me to meet him when he arrived on board a Polish liner in the harbor of Gdynia. Or Gdynia, I don't know, G-Y-D-N-I-A. The Poles wished to show him special honor. Instead of occupying a compartment in the comfortable new sleeping car running between Gdynia and Warsaw, Mr. Cudahy was placed in a private car. It was not much bigger than an American caboose. It was one of those very small and old cars inherited from the rolling stock of Tsarist Russia. It had four wheels and contained one large and two small compartments and an observation platform. This light vehicle was attached to the end of a fast train, and as we bounced along over the not-too-any-too-good Polish roadbed, I felt sorry for the ambassador, who was bouncing even more emphatically in his car at the tail end of the train. In the morning when we arrived in Warsaw, I hastened to the end of the train and watched Mr. Cudahy slowly and painfully step to the platform. "Did you get any sleep?" I queried. "No," he replied. "Don't ask me about that awful trip. Don't you see I have to smile for the photographers?" That evening in the hotel, Mr. Cudahy phoned suggesting we go out for dinner in some nice quiet hotel not too far from Warsaw. "I suppose you mean the country club," I said. "That would be fine," he assented. I broke the news that Warsaw had no country club, and there was not a single restaurant in the neighborhood of Warsaw fit to eat in, and the best restaurant in the city was Simon & Stocki, S-T-O-C-K-I, just across the street. I invited Michael Obarski, O-B-A-R-S-K-I, managing editor of the Polish Telegraph Agency, to join us. Obarski was a good newspaperman and a friend of many years standing. Because of his government connections, he was a good man for the ambassador to know. The disappearance of the ambassador from the hotel frightened the personnel of the embassy, and the staff went out to search for him. We were soon discovered by one of the secretaries who, uninvited, imposed himself in our company. I consoled the ambassador, informing him he must submit to this form of control as long as he held to this post. Mr. Cuddy, he had many experiences in Poland, some amusing, others unpleasant. He was an enthusiastic hunter, the American ambassador, and he hunted after big game in Africa, Alaska, and many other distant places. The Poles invited him to attend one of the diplomatic hunts arranged for Reichsmarshal Göring at Białowieża, one of the largest forests in Europe, where the Polish kings once held their hunts. I met him after one of these hunts, and he was a very disappointed man. Białowieża, B-I-A-L-O-W-I-C-C-Z-A, maybe. There are typos in this book, and I've heard that name before, but look it up on the map if you need to. Anyway, one of the largest forests in Europe where the Polish kings held their hunts. When Cudahy returned to Washington, he arranged to have another post. In my cable about his transfer, I mentioned that he had been promoted to American minister to Ireland. Later, Cudahy was again appointed ambassador, this time to Belgium. His courageous defense of King Leopold against the defamation campaign and the British propagandists against the ended his political career under the Roosevelt administration. That's FDR. In his thoughts and actions, Cudahy represented the real United States, not the Roosevelt cabal. He and Kennedy, who for a short period represented America at the court of King St. James, the court of St. James, it's in England, stood out among the Roosevelt appointees abroad. See, Roosevelt, again, was trying to keep us out of war with, this is the thing, people like me who were raised to hate the Kennedys as loathsome liberals, the older JFK tried as hard as he could to keep the U.S. out of war with Nazi Germany. And that has to be accounted a very, very good thing, as well as the America First Command. He took a lot of abuse from the Jews for actually trying to look out for American interests when he was at the ambassador to England or the UK under at the Court of St. James, as it's called. And what Donald Day is saying here is that this Cudahy was also a genuinely pro-American ambassador to Ireland, to Belgium, and to Poland. So he and Kennedy, who for a short period represented America at the Court of St. James, stood out among the Roosevelt appointees abroad. Perhaps it is of some significance that both men are Catholics, and the Catholic Church in the United States, which reflects a large section of public opinion, opposed the entry of America into the war. Now, a lot of Catholics are Irish, as well as German in the U.S., and they wanted to stay out of this war, not least because they don't particularly like England, and they know how dishonest and destructive it can be. And if we'd listened to them, we would have been a lot better off. But America was under the thrall of the Jews, and second to that, the Anglomaniacs, who got us involved in World War I and actively persecuted German nationals who lived in the U.S. But you never hear about that. You'll hear about the Japanese being interned. You won't hear that there were Americans of German descent and Italian descent who were also interned, not in the same numbers as the Japanese in World War II, but in the thousands. Never, ever hear about that. Moving on to page 96, just a couple more and we'll be done here with chapter 8, but it's good stuff. The Polish press in the United States occasionally furnishes evidence concerning the ambition of the Poles and other unassimilated minorities to change the character of American culture. The New American, not the Birch publication, but the official monthly organ of the Polish Students and Alumni Association of America, in its issue of November 1938, discussed the appeal of a writer named Louis Adamic, A-D-A-M-I-C, asking for material to help him describe a complete picture of the Polish American. Bronis Kalp, B-R-O-N-I-S-K-A-L-P, probably Kalpinski, writes, quote, "And I felt here that we must respond, for we have waited long for this man who wants to speak for us and for the rest of those who live here and who want to help in the building of America, not by discarding the ancient culture of their ancestors, but by contributing it to all the other cultures for the formation of the ultimate America. As Lewis Adamic, or Adamic, says, the true American will come when all the best parts of each culture will be taken to use in the making of an entirely new American culture based on all traditions and not only on the Anglo-Saxon. Echoes of a Jew Horace Callan's multiculturalism you'll hear there. This is not, says Day, a single challenge. It is being voiced by many who are allied to American spirit and culture, which, despite its defects and shortcomings, did develop the pre-Roosevelt United States, which had admirers and friends all over the world. Roosevelt, together with the foreign groups in America, is today liquidating democracy in the United States, and democracy itself fosters the very weaknesses which contribute and aid to its destruction. The downfall of democracy is due very largely to corruption. Democracy is tolerant of corruption because it is so corrupt itself. Under a democratic form of government, groups of men form political parties to promote group or class interests. In cities and nations where reside many different nationalities, those groups are more in number than places where the population is homogeneous. Remember how the people who founded the U.S. didn't want political parties. They wanted to be one nation of basically of one stock, Northwestern European and primarily British. They didn't want rival political factions rising and looking after interests and looking to the central state to supply their needs out of the pockets of other men. What's that Bastiat quote, the libertarians like the French guy? Government is the contrivance by which we all seek to live out of the pockets of others, more or less. That's a paraphrase. It's not exact. So he's saying basically democracy is inherently corrupt, inherently splinters into political parties who are promoting group or class interests rather than the interests of the nation as a whole. New York City has always contained the largest percentage of foreigners of all major American cities. It is largely because of this that the administration of New York City is the most dishonest and corrupt in the United States. Remember, Tammany Hall is probably the first or best known corrupt city administration, and was ridiculed by Nast, political cartoonist Nast. It was of German descent, I might note. A very large book could be written about corruption in American municipal politics. Politicians devote much of their time to thinking of ways and means to divert taxpayers' money into their own pockets and into those of their followers and supporters. While I have written of the corrupt politics in other nations, I wish to emphasize here that we have the same varieties of corruption in America. The terrible extent of municipal corruption in the United States, cities and towns, is passively accepted by the electorate. Newspapers are forever fighting and exposing it. Occasionally the voters go to the polls and oust a dishonest administration, but the cleanup is seldom permanent. The cities in the United States which have an honest and efficient administration are few and far between. This corruption spread first into the governments of different states. For many years, the national administration was comparatively honest and efficient. Graft and corruption were limited to a few appropriation measures, such as the so-called Rivers and Harbors Bill, which enabled the senators and congressmen to reward some of their faithful with government money for a pretense of service and work. This bill was allegedly to keep harbors and rivers open to navigation. The First World War introduced corruption on a large scale into Washington. And remember, that's under Bernard Baruch and the War Control Board, where you had war socialism. And this is, he's saying, this is where the start of the corruption came in at the national level. Also, at the same time, you have the size of the federal government metastasizing. The only prior thing that greatly expanded it and corrupted it was the pensions for the people who fought in the Civil War. Under Lincoln, you had the consolidation and its justification by courtier professors, or typically Jews, or those who go along with their ideology that centralized states are more advanced than decentralized politics, as was the case with the founding of the U.S. It was more decentralized. Centralized under Lincoln, and really truly expanded and turned to all these different progressive permanent bureaucracies before and after World War One. And he's saying, the First World War introduced corruption on a large scale into Washington. The attempt to prohibit the sale of alcohol throughout the U.S. introduced corruption and disrespect for the law into the American family itself. Out of prohibition developed gangsters and racketeers who corrupted police departments, the judiciary, and the local and government officials. Catholics are against prohibition, whereas the Protestants, it's a Protestant moral mania to stamp out evil in the form of personal vices like smoking or drinking alcohol. And it leads, abolitionism is another example, leads to, the cure is worse than the disease, is how you sum it up. It must be said to the credit of the older Saxon and other Nordic elements in America that they furnished a very small percentage of this lawless, antisocial element in American life. The great majority of the gangsters and their ilk come from unassimilated aliens, among whom the Jews and Italians play the leading role, both as active lawbreakers and as lawyers who counseled and defended these criminals before the courts. It is an interesting fact that the development of mismanagement, corruption, and graft in American cities is almost in direct proportion to the increase of the foreign element. And today we can regard the Roosevelt administration as the first minority government in the United States history. And with Roosevelt, the corruption in the national government has approached those depths of dishonesty exemplified by New York City. During the past decade, we have seen in Europe many instances where corruption became so widespread in general that it threatened the existence of the nation itself. There have been revolts in many countries which have turned to authoritarian forms of government, dictatorships. There are many different kinds of dictatorships. Sometimes they represent a special class of the population. Sometimes they represent the desire of an entire nation which, disillusioned with the breakdown of democratic government, willingly supports a movement which promises to clean up. I think he's referring to Hitler there. If we study the history of Europe after the First World War, one of the most remarkable developments is the collapse of the democratic form of government. The new European states, sired by President Wilson's proclamation, quote-unquote, self-determination of small nations, self-determination is the key phrase, and damned by the Versailles Treaty, all adopted the French parliamentary system of government. So Wilson's self-determination, Germany signing the treaty, the rise of these small new states with the parliamentary system of government that allows small ones to be elected rather than the U.S. system. This proportional system of representation, whereby any political group could obtain a place in government if it could obtain sufficient votes, looks lovely on paper, and it functioned for a few years in several new states. Lithuania's parliamentary system was the first among the new states to collapse. From her Declaration of Independence on 16 February 1918 until 1926, when Professor Augustinus Waldemaras, W-A-L-D-E-M-A-R-A-S, Waldemaras, pulled off his first successful putsch, Lithuania had 14 cabinets, so 14 cabinets in 8 years and then a putsch by Waldemaras. Each functioned on an average of 8 months, while a new parliament was elected on an average of every 18 months. Lithuania had 7 parties of Lithuanians and 4 representing its minorities, some of which were also split into subdivisions. The parliamentary system broke down in Italy, Germany, Poland, Latvia, Estonia, and in other countries. In all these states, the nationally minded element inherited control of the government. It's like if a white party took over from the corruption of the Republicans and Democrats with the idea of cleaning it up from all the garbage we see today. As we within my recording of these sessions, we moved $18 trillion into debt. Borders open with Mexico. We let the rich Chinese who have funded our incredible deficit spending to back the warfare, welfare state with the endless international war to support Israel come in here and buy up our best property on the coast. Okay, so he said, this is key now here. In all these states, the nationally minded element inherited control of the government. Internationally minded elements, the communist, socialist, clerical parties and minorities were outlawed. So grouping the Catholics and the Jews, the internationally minded Christianity is universalist. Anyone can become a member, and the church claims it is the one true path Catholics claim they're the one true church, and that means everyone needs them, from the lowliest pygmy running around the Congo assassinating bluebirds with his dart gun. He needs Catholicism every much as the most atheist, even-minded, equanimical Swede. They all need the one true path. So they're international, they're global, whereas nationalism would be limited to one nation. So, I'll read that again just because it's important. In all these states, the nationally minded element inherited control of the government, the new states formed after World War I. Internationally minded elements, communist, socialist, clerical parties, and minorities, were outlawed. This was the first stage of the European Revolution. It was, in most countries, a revolution of the youth. Youth is always in the majority. Democrat-corrupt governments are afraid of the youth. Some states fix the voting age as high as 25 years for men. Youth is usually radically minded. My boss, Colonel McCormick, coined an apt epigram when he said, "The man who has not been a socialist before he is 25 has no heart. The man who is a socialist after he is 25 has no brain." Well, I've seen that attributed to Churchill, so I don't know why he's thinking McCormick. Churchill, in Churchill's quote, he used liberal and conservative. So I don't know if he's amending that or offering a variant. Who knows? But anyway, as the colonel is an outstanding patriot, he probably referred to international socialism. For at the time of this remark, the conception of national socialism was unknown in America. The revolutionary movements in Europe attracted not only youth, but parents who raised children only to see them confronted with the specters of unemployment and hunger. The new governments found their primary and most important task was to provide work for their people. Many succeeded. That's debatable. Corruption was most certainly has not been entirely eradicated, but throughout Europe there seems to be a general movement toward honesty. In the United States, this movement has not yet begun to crystallize. Although combating corruption may appear almost as hopeless a task as frustrating fornication being illicit sex, that is, sex between unmarried people. Unless corruption is curbed, we may as well prepare for communist revolutions in the remaining democratic countries and the extinction of those classes who have tolerated this state of affairs. Good white men who know better. Not many nations have succeeded in retaining a parliamentary form of government. In those countries where the party system survives, party and class politics have been largely abandoned for the duration of the war. A realization seems to be growing that their future existence depends upon their government's ability to combat corruption and give their people an honest and efficient administration. Many clear-thinking economists foresaw the present world convulsion years ago and published warnings against it. Their warnings passed unheeded. There is no doubt that the epoch of capitalism is drawing to an end and that the day of the organizers, as Dr. von Oftan points out, has dawned. He's completely wrong about that, as were many back in those times. Today the world is in a process of reorganization. This is even admitted in the ruling circles of England and the United States, where there's been much discussion of the after-war world. President Roosevelt and Premier Churchill have promised the world four freedoms. It does not matter much what they are, although I recall something about freedom from fear, freedom from poverty, freedom from work, and freedom passes to all baseball and football games. Just upon past performance, the promises of either of these men are not very attractive. Besides, they are cherishing as their ally the Jewish Bolshevik government of Russia, which will have nothing to do with the four freedoms. And since these men are openly allied with the Jews, let us devote the next chapter to them. So that we will do tomorrow, and we'll leave off there for today. That's chapter 7 and 8. And tomorrow I will record chapter 9 on the Jews. I might add chapter 10. We'll see. But, so we've made our way now through 99 pages. And we're about halfway through Onward Christian Soldiers by Donald Day, written back in the 40s, or the manuscript was completed back in the 40s, a correspondent in Northern and Eastern Europe. Me reading this, I'm Alex Linder. I'm at alexlinder.com. My main work and home is at vnnforum.com. Follow me on Twitter at the Linder Files. And I will be back. Recorded this on, just to keep our place in time, It's just afternoon now on 12/9, December 9th, 2014. Like I say, I'll be back tomorrow with at least Chapter 9. Thank you for listening, and good day.